World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented on behalf of Admiral dealers all over America. Today, Bob Trout, veteran foreign correspondent and news analyst, takes over as editor of World News Today, replacing Douglas Edwards, who has left for London at assignment to the Western Front. Now for the news and reports from the leading news centers here and abroad, here is Bob Trout.
Marshal Joseph Stalin has issued an order of the day announcing the capture of Kolberg, the German Baltic port and naval base in Pomerania, northeast of Stettin. On the Western Front, headquarters announced today that part of the Ludendorff Bridge has collapsed, carrying a number of American engineers into the swiftly flowing Rhine 70 feet below. According to the official information, enemy action was not directly responsible. By one of those odd coincidences, a few hours after the Ludendorff Bridge fell in, the Germans announced that four German officers had been put to death after a court-martial for neglect of duty, which permitted the American First Army to capture the bridge 10 days ago. The 3rd and 7th Armies are closing in on the Tsar Basin today, and the United States Army Air Force sent its greatest fleet of bombers to attack targets in Berlin, 1,300 American heavy bombers and 700 fighters. The Tokyo radio, without confirmation, insists that some 1,400 American carrier-based planes raided southern Japan for 8 hours. And now for a report from Supreme Headquarters, Admiral takes you to CBS Paris, Eric Severide reporting.
The battle to clear the Rhineland has gone well this Sunday. Nothing sensational, but good steady progress all along the fronts with no setbacks anywhere, at least so far as we've heard here at Shape. The bridgehead over the Rhine is 14 miles long and 7.5 deep, and that makes it about the size of the famous Anzio beachhead in Italy. You may know that one center span of the Remagen Bridge suddenly collapsed, which puts that celebrated bridge out of use. But we are assured it does not hamper our activities to any great extent. We have other means now for crossing the river there. The Germans didn't knock the bridge out, but our own previous bombing and their shelling had weakened it. We had tried to strengthen the span, but it was too far gone. We are not told just what was on the bridge, if anything, at the moment of collapse. We have still a few blocks to clear in the city of Koblenz, where again it's a case of house-to-house fighting. Just south of there, the 9th Infantry has taken the town of Beaupard and holds a 10-mile strip of the Rhine banks in that area. Patch's 7th Army has made progress, and there's been heavy fighting among the Dragon's Teeth and tank ditches of the Siegfried Line. On his extreme right wing, Patch has French units fighting with him, and they went ahead along the Rhine there some 2 miles, taking several villages and Fort Louis, which was one of the key knots in the old Maginot Line. This is a great squeeze play by the 3rd and 7th Armies. They are pushing the legs of the triangle slowly together, and as they do so, clearing a long stretch of the Rhine banks from both north and south. Patton's men took 2,800 prisoners yesterday alone. Every day, even without sensational conquests of ground, we gather in several thousand Germans, and with their killed and wounded, it makes a daily total of losses which is just too high for any army to suffer without being very seriously weakened. This is Eric Severide in Paris. Now back to Admiral in New York.
And now for a report on the day's air activity over Germany, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
What with the Prime Minister saying the war may be over this summer and the 4th Armored Division tearing around in the valley of the Middle Rhine, a new sense of urgency has come into the discussion of British post-war plans. It's as though people had suddenly realized that they are going to have to do something about all these problems they've been talking about for so long. For that reason, there'll be some rough and tumble debates in the House of Commons next week. Britain's legislators will be discussing some of the thorniest of post-war problems. On Tuesday, they debate civil aviation, and there are sure to be many hard criticisms of America, whose point of view on the future of the airways is very different from that of Britain. On Wednesday, there's the second reading of the Distribution of Industry Bill. Now, this is a bold measure which would give the government power to say where new factories can be set up and where they can't be set up. And it's sure to run into trouble from rock-ribbed believers in free enterprise. Then, on Thursday and Friday, the House of Commons will debate housing, which is one of the most pressing of all post-war problems in Britain. It's a downright question of getting roofs over people's heads. Something like 2 million houses have been made uninhabitable, and every V-bomb that lands may knock down some more. When all the men in all of Britain's armies abroad come back, they're going to want some place to live, and all the people who are now living in patched-up houses are going to want them repaired. And it's all part of the government's job to see that this gets done. And the House of Commons, sensing the will of the British people, is going to put on considerable pressure next week to see that it is done. So what with civil aviation, location of industry, and housing, the British Parliament will be considering a pretty good cross-section of post-war problems next week. Much fur will fly. But when it is over, the picture of Britain after the war will be that much clearer. This is Charles Collingwood in London, returning you to New York.
And now here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
The Admiral Dual Temp is the post-war refrigerator that will really be two refrigerators in one. Dual Temp will be the refrigerator with a built-in home freezer that will actually quick-freeze foods and will store up to 80 pounds of frozen foods for months. It is important to remember that the Dual Temp is not an experiment, but has given complete satisfaction to thousands of users for the past 8 years. Only in Admiral Dual Temp will you get the huge, purified, moist cold compartment that never has to be defrosted. The Admiral has no frost-collecting set of coils to draw the moisture and vitamins from your foods. So you don't have to defrost, and you don't have to use covered dishes to keep foods fresh and appetizing. Yes, the Admiral Dual Temp is really two refrigerators in one, each completely separate and insulated from the other. Admiral Dual Temp will be the most important improvement in home refrigeration in 20 years. When you can own one, you'll agree the Admiral Dual Temp is a different kind of refrigerator. Dual Temp is the successor to the ordinary mechanical refrigerator. And remember, only Admiral can build a Dual Temp. Now here once again is Bob Trout.
Two WACs are now stationed in the Marianas. For a recording of an interview with them, Admiral takes you to CBS San Francisco, Webley Edwards reporting.
Task forces of the 21st Bomber Command have made history these last 2 weeks with incendiary bomber raids that tore at the heart of four Japanese principal cities with fire that seared and burned out their vitals. Four times they've struck at specified targets, with precise bombing of parts of these cities that were important to Japan's war industries and communications and transportation. Tokyo got it first in its central portion, in factories, administrative, and military centers, as well as its important home industries, were destroyed or put out of effective use, so far as we may learn from photographic reconnaissance. Then it was Nagoya, down the coast from Tokyo, followed shortly afterward by Osaka, and then Kobe, transportation center and chief port of Japan. These history-making incendiary attacks were by the B-29 forces of the 21st Bomber Command, based in these Marianas Islands. This morning, in my travels out north on the island of Guam, I was startled to encounter in this man's world a lady wearing the uniform of the United States Army. And further, it developed she had a companion, also a lady of the Army. Further investigation proved them to be the only two WACs, Women's Army Corps, in the entire Marianas Islands. They are in the AFPOA, which means Army Air Forces, Pacific Ocean Areas, under the general operation of SINCPOA, which means Commander-in-Chief, Pacific Ocean Areas. They are also in the group on Guam who sweat it out when the B-29 Super Forts are on the road to Japan and back. I trust it's all right for me to say a lady sweats it out.
That's exactly what we do.
Well, 7 months ago, we were recapturing this island of Guam, and it's a pretty good indication of the great growth and development of this forward area base that at least two WAC officers are among us. How did you ladies ever get out here?
We've been in the Pacific for 15 months. We were with the first contingent of WACs that left San Francisco, and since then we've done plenty of traveling. We are in New Caledonia on the staff of the commanding general of the Army Forces for the South Pacific. When AFPOA was organized, we were transferred back to Hawaii and then out here.
Well, now that we're this well acquainted, I hope, may I ask for your names?
Captain Elizabeth Wooden from Sacramento, California.
Your parents live there in Sacramento?
Yes, they are Mr. and Mrs. I.J. Wooden from 1339 42nd Street.
And you, Captain?
Captain Ethel Hoffman, Chicago, Illinois. My mother and father are Mr. and Mrs. Rue Hoffman, 1640 53rd Street, Chicago.
Now, just what do you ladies do out here in this far forward area, Captain Wooden?
I am Secretary for Major General Willis H. Hale, the Commanding General, AFPOA, and Deputy Commander, 20th Air Force.
And you, Captain Hoffman?
I'm an administrative assistant to the Chief of Staff, Army Air Forces, Pacific Ocean Areas.
Well, now, how do you feel about women being out here in the far forward areas, Captain Hoffman?
We're all for it. We think it's all right. It's only natural that as the fighting frontier is pushed further toward Japan, the WACs will be needed out here, and we will move forward with them, just as we've done all over the world.
Well, I believe everybody out here thinks that's kind of a nice thing. The serious, useful way you ladies of the WACs get in there and do a man's job where you're needed. And those flyers of yours have been doing pretty well for us all, haven't they?
I don't know what the high command has planned, but the B-29s have knocked out the heart of four main Japanese cities in the last 9 days. And I guess there will be plenty more ahead. And we're very proud of them. We think what they are doing is shortening the war. And that's what everybody wants.
Well, thank you for being our guests, Captain Elizabeth Wooden of Sacramento and Captain Ethel Hoffman of Chicago, Women's Army Corps attached to the Army Air Force Pacific Ocean Areas at Guam. This is Webley Edwards at Guam. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Back again in New York, and now here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott, with a few words on Kolberg and the Baltic region of the Russian front. Major Elliott.
For the moment, the Russians appear to be devoting their main effort to clearing up German pockets of resistance along the Baltic shore and generally improving their situation on their northern flank. These efforts are meeting with some success. Marshal Stalin has just announced the capture of the important Baltic port of Kolberg, an operation in which the Polish First Army participated with the First White Russian Army Group of Marshal Zhukov. The German resistance area around Danzig and Gdynia is being steadily narrowed down. In the direction of Stettin, the Russians are attacking the bridgehead, which the Germans still hold on the east side of the Oder estuary. All of this not only improves the Russian military position by making their hold on Pomerania and West Prussia more secure, so that their coming major drive on Berlin will have no danger point on its right flank, but it also cuts down the German ability to use the Baltic Sea to supply the pocketed German forces in the Königsberg area of East Prussia and in Latvia. We should remember that German command of the Baltic is dependent on the remains of the German surface fleet, which is now entirely concentrated in Baltic waters. This fleet consists of two so-called pocket battleships, two 8-inch gun cruisers, four 6-inch gun cruisers, and perhaps as many as 20 or 25 destroyers. Its main bases in the Baltic are Kiel and Swinemunde, both well to the westward, but in the eastern Baltic, it is chiefly dependent on Gdynia. This was a former Polish naval base taken over and refitted by the Germans. Should Gdynia be lost, as it seems likely to be very shortly, the German Baltic fleet will have no good refitting base available to it in the eastern Baltic, and its operations there will be considerably restricted. Moreover, we must view this picture in reverse. So far, the Soviet Baltic fleet has been severely restricted in its operations just for lack of a suitable base. Its main bases, now in its possession, are in the Gulf of Finland at Kronstadt and at Tallinn. Up to this time, the Russian armies have not captured any suitable base farther down the Baltic. They have, indeed, captured several ports, such as Memel and Elbing and now Kolberg, but none of these are equipped as naval bases. Libau and Pilau, which do have naval equipment in some measure, are still in German hands. But if Gdynia should be taken by the Russian armies, the Soviet Baltic fleet would then be able to operate much farther to the westward, provided it has sufficient strength in ships to deal with the German fleet or what is left of it. What is really at stake in all these operations in the Baltic is a supply route by sea to the German armies trapped in East Prussia and Latvia. And that is why the Germans are making such a desperate defense of Gdynia and Danzig. Now here again is Bob Trout.
That was Major Elliott. In Rome today, Pope Pius told a large congregation assembled in St. Peter's Square that we must return to the spirit of brotherhood, of real Christian brotherhood, and turn away from the doctrines of race and blood. The Pope said, "It is an evil spirit which has produced the present conflagration. many are suffering without homes, but much suffering would be relieved if all men stood by God. So spoke the Pope in Rome today. Here in New York, Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia announced this afternoon that the city's midnight curfew has been extended from midnight to 1 o'clock in the morning. Said the mayor, a rigid curfew just won't work in New York City. He told of a serious transportation jam resulting from the midnight curfew in Manhattan. The one-hour extension is expected to give the city police several hundred more police hours for enforcement. And Mayor LaGuardia declared, if this hour of tolerance is abused, we'll have to shove it right back. But, he said, I don't think it will be abused. The question of food is coming in for a lot of attention in America in general and in Washington in particular. And so for a summary of the food situation and other developments, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
We haven't heard the last word on food. Republicans in Congress this week will demand an explanation of the new slash in meat rations. Bills may be introduced to limit the amount of food that can be exported. And several committees are getting ready to investigate the administration's food policies. The Senate Agricultural Committee has a head start, and by no stretch of the imagination could it be described as a warm friend of the New Deal. Officials of the War Food Administration tell me that the cut in civilian rations will go beyond meat and include butter, most fats and oils, and canned milk. There may be temporary reductions in other home front supplies, too. They don't expect the meat situation to improve until fall. The overall curtailment of civilian rations will continue after VE Day. It will last until Europe is better prepared to feed itself. But there's no fear in the government that home front supplies will be cut below a healthy level. A special unit has been created in the War Food Administration to establish the supplies needed for American civilians. And War Mobilizer Byrne's Special Committee on Food Allocations will be a check against draining away home front rations. This whole problem of food has been boiling up behind the scenes in Washington for at least 2 months. The United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration has complained to the White House regularly that Europe was starving. War Food Administrator Jones has protested that he was never given any specific estimate on food exports. He also questioned the British food reserves. The problem of food came up at the Crimea Conference. The American delegation was informed that hunger is affecting the stability of the continent and might even threaten the efforts of the United Nations to develop a lasting alliance. Mr. Roosevelt put one of the ablest of his anonymous aides, Dr. Isidore Lubin, on the job of surveying Europe's food needs. This report was on the president's desk when he told us Friday we would have to tighten our belts. The report revealed most Europeans are eating less now than before D-Day. The Germans looted as they left. Internal transportation was badly wrecked, and military needs have hogged most of the shipping. 12 million displaced persons, slave workers, and uprooted families in Europe must be fed. The army is afraid if they are not, disease epidemics will break out and be carried to our troops. The Dutch are literally starving to death. This is true to varying degrees of other areas still occupied by the Germans. The Nazis are deliberately trying to starve all non-Germans to weaken Europe. Incidentally, you will be interested to know that the United Nations Relief Agency has decided against feeding German civilians from Allied food stocks. They will have to scrounge for themselves, as one spokesman told me. Here's the way the food picture lines up. American civilians had an average of 3,367 calories a day last year. The Greeks had only 700 calories to sustain themselves. Only 30% of Greece's lowest needs can be produced locally. The average daily consumption of the Yugoslavs last year was 1,900 calories, the French 2,230, and the British 2,923. The way we've been allocating food, the Army and Navy have top priority. But there is an ironical note to this. German prisoners, in some cases, eat better than Allied civilians because the Army feeds them. The American home front has second call on food supplies. Lend-Lease is third and Allied civilians fourth. Now back to Bob Trout and Admiral Radio in New York.
In the week that's just passed, the great battlefields of Europe, East and West, have more than ever before taken on a unified shape. Just as General Eisenhower in the West has been clearing out the German pockets before the Rhine, so have the Russian commanders been occupied in tidying up the front before the River Oder. After the Yalta meeting, it was announced that the two fronts would be coordinated. Since then, we've seen planes taking off from Britain to fly combat missions on the Russian front. And this week, the shape of the ground fronts bears a startling similarity. The Russians are cleaning up the loose ends in Pomerania and East Prussia. The Western Allies are clearing out the Tsar Basin and the Palatinate. General Eisenhower has a bridgehead on the Middle Rhine. Marshal Zhukov appears to have some sort of bridgehead on the Middle Oder. The Germans say there are now about 100,000 Americans in the Rhine bridgehead. And the Germans say there are now about 100,000 Russians in the Oder bridgehead. Whatever the truth may be regarding the figures, it is true that on both fronts, east and west, the Germans must stretch themselves thin, perhaps thinner than ever before, to guard the last lines that separate the fringes of Germany from the heart of Germany. The Germans may hope to guess correctly where the main blows will be struck, across the Rhine and across the Oder. But with the last major centers of German war industry about to fall into Allied hands, the Germans cannot seriously hope to escape defeat. It's been a great week in the air over Europe, climaxed today by that great American daylight raid on the targets in Berlin. All week long, British and American planes, of all sizes and all shapes, too, have been attacking so many German targets that no civilian could follow all the details, and probably few of the aviators themselves had time to watch the parts of the air pattern their colleagues were stamping on the enemy country. The British, who've long been dropping the world's heaviest and most powerful bomb, the earthquake bomb, announced a new one, almost twice as heavy as the earthquake bomb. The new monster weighs 11 tons. Used on railroad yards last week, it left huge craters where tracks and platforms had been. Apparently, the new bomb has not been officially named by the British government, but it seems likely that an unofficial name will be found by the Royal Air Force flyers, who shrink from exaggeration and delight in understatement. These are the young British aviators who made one giant bomb famous by giving it the affectionate name of Cookie. The United States Army Air Force in the Pacific has been busy this week marking out a new kind of air pattern for the home islands of Japan. Four times in 7 days, the superfortresses have flown in greater strength than before, more than 300 planes arrayed, to drop clouds of incendiaries into the heart of Japan's greatest cities. The new type of B-29 air attack sharply contrasts with the type of bombing American planes have previously done in this war in any theater. The evidence is that the four great fire raids are just the beginning for the big B-29s, which clearly are about to come into their own now that the technical difficulties have been worked out. And now to tell you about Slide Away, the open door to good music, here is Warren Sweeney.
On the Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers, can give you Slide Away. With Admiral Slide Away, you simply open the cabinet doors and out slides your complete phonograph turntable and automatic record changer.
Do you mean it's as easy as that with an Admiral? Just open the cabinet doors and the automatic record changer comes right out in plain view?
Yes, it's as easy as that with an Admiral. Just open the doors, out it comes. Close the doors, it disappears. That's why Admiral named it Slide Away. And it's an exclusive Admiral feature, you know.
Well, it certainly seems that with the record changer out in plain view, it would be simple to load and unload.
Simple is the word, all right. And it's a grand feeling to be able to load your Admiral automatic changer with 10 or 12 of your favorite records and enjoy hearing them flawlessly played one after another without going near the machine. Yes, Admiral Slide Away is the open door to good music. And remember, when you buy your post-war radio phonograph, you'll get Slide Away only in Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Give now to the 1945 War Fund. When you give to your Red Cross, you have the satisfaction of knowing that you are a part of a humanitarian institution with one purpose, to help the unfortunate. So contribute now, and more than ever before. Be glad you can give to such a deserving organization. Your G.I. Joe will bless you for it. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral dual-temp refrigerators, Admiral home freezers, Admiral electric ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is Warren Sweeney speaking coast to coast for Admiral. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.